Audiobook of Thy Uber Prophecy of Michel Desmarques. Believing is not enough. You need to know. First published as Abduction to the Ninth Planet in 1993. Preface. I have written this book as the result of orders received and which I have obeyed. Further, it is an account of events that happened to me personally, this I affirm. I imagine that, to some extent, this extraordinary story will appear to some readers as science fiction, a story entirely invented, but I do not have the imagination that such a fabrication would require. This is not science fiction. The reader of good faith will be able to recognize the truth in the message I transmit from my new friends to the people of the planet Earth. This message, in spite of numerous references to races and religions, reflects neither racial nor religious bias on behalf of the author. Michel Desmarques, January, 1989. 1. Chapter 4. I awoke suddenly, not knowing how long I had slept. I was completely awake, fresh and alert, but good God, what time could it be? Lena was sleeping beside me, her fists closed, but then Lena always sleeps. I had no desire at all to go back to sleep, and besides, it was possibly already 5 in the morning. I got up, made my way to the kitchen and checked the clock. Only 12:30 a.m. It was unusual for me to wake up at such an hour. I took off my pajamas and dressed in trousers and a shirt. Why, I had no idea. Neither can I explain why I went to my desk, took a sheet of paper and a biro and watched myself write, as if my hand had a mind of its own. My dear, I'll be away for about 10 days. Absolutely no need to worry. Leaving the note by the telephone, I headed through the door and onto the veranda. I avoided the table on which last night's chess game remained, with the white king still in checkmate, and silently opened the door leading onto the garden. The night seemed to be suffused with a strange brightness, which had nothing to do with the stars. Instinctively, I tried to recall what phase the moon was currently in, thinking that perhaps it was about to rise. Here, in the northeast of Australia where I live, the nights are generally quite clear. I descended the outside stairs and headed towards the pandanus. Usually, at this time of night, we would have a veritable concert from the frogs and crickets whose chirring sounds fill the night. Now, however, there was a heavy silence and I wondered why. I had only walked a few steps when, quite suddenly, the color of the philodendrons changed. The wall of the house too, and the pandanus, all were bathed in a kind of bluish light. The lawn seemed to undulate beneath my feet and the ground beneath the pandanus waved also. The philodendrons distorted and the wall of the house resembled a sheet floating in the wind. Beginning to believe that I was not well, I decided to return to the house when, at that precise moment, I felt myself lifted quite gently from the ground. I rose, slowly at first, above the philodendrons, and then quicker, until I saw the house becoming smaller and smaller below me. "What is happening?" I exclaimed in utter bewilderment. "All is well now, Michel." By then, I believed I was dreaming. Before me, a human being of impressive size, dressed in a one-piece suit and wearing a completely transparent helmet on her head, was looking at me, friendly and smiling. "No, you are not dreaming," she said, answering the question in my mind. "Yes," I replied, "but it always happens this way in a dream, and in the end you find you've fallen out of bed and have a lump on your forehead." She smiled. "Further," I continued, "you are speaking to me in French, my native tongue, and yet we are in Australia. I do speak English, you know. So do I. It has to be a dream, one of those stupid dreams. Moreover, if not though, what are you doing on my property?" "We are not on your property, but above it." "Ah. It is a nightmare. You see, I was right. I'll pinch myself." I accompanied the words with the action. "Ouch." She smiled again. "Now are you satisfied, Michel? But if it's not a dream, why am I here, sitting on this rock? Who are those people over there, dressed in the fashion of the last century? I was beginning to distinguish, in a milky light, people talking and at a slight distance, others moving around. And you, who are you? Why aren't you normal-sized? I am a normal size, Michelle. On my planet we are all this size. But everything in good time, my dear friend. I hope you don't mind me calling you that. If we aren't good friends already, I am sure that we will be soon. She stood there in front of me, intelligence reflected in her smiling face and goodness emanating from her entire being. It would not be possible to meet anyone with whom I could feel more at ease. Of course, you may call me what you wish. And what is your name? My name is Thor, but first, I would like you to know, once and for all, that this is not a dream. Indeed, it is something quite different. For certain reasons which will be explained to you later, you have been chosen to undertake a journey which very few Earthlings have made, particularly in recent times. We are, you and I, at this moment, in a universe which is parallel to that of Earth. In order to admit you, as well as ourselves, we have made use of an airlock. At this instant, time has stopped for you, and you could remain here 20 or 50 of your earthly years and then return as if you hadn't left. Your physical body would remain absolutely unchanged. But what are these people doing? They exist as well as can be expected and, as you will learn later, the population density is very low. Death only occurs by suicide or accident. Time is suspended. There are men and women, as well as some animals who are 30,000, 50,000 or even many more Earth years old. But why are they here and how did they come to be here? Where were they born? On Earth. They are all here by accident. By accident? What do you mean? It's very simple. You have heard of the Bermuda Triangle? I nodded. Well, quite simply, in this spot and in others less well known, this parallel universe becomes confused with your universe so that there exists between them a natural warp. People, animals or even objects finding themselves in the immediate vicinity of a warp are literally sucked into it. Thus, you can have, for example, an entire fleet of boats disappear in several seconds. Sometimes a person, or persons, can pass back into your universe after several hours, several days or several years. More often, however, they never return. When a man does return and relates his experience, the vast majority of people don't believe him, and if he persists, he is assumed crazy. Most of the time, such a person recounts nothing at all, realizing how he will appear in the eyes of his peers. Sometimes too, he returns amnesic, and if he recovers some memory, it is not of what happened in the parallel universe, and therefore sheds no light on the subject. There was, Thau continued, a typical case of this passage into a parallel universe in North America, where a young man literally vanished while going to fetch water from a well which was situated several hundred meters from his house. About an hour later, family and friends set out in search of him and, as there had been a fresh snowfall of about 20 centimeters, it should have been quite simple. They had only to follow the footprints left by the young man. But, right in the middle of the field, the footprints stopped. There were no trees around, no rocks onto which he could have jumped, nothing strange or unusual, the footprints just stopped. Some people believed that he had been taken by a spacecraft, but that could not have been, as you will see later. This poor man had quite simply been sucked into the parallel universe. I remember, I said, I did hear of that particular case, but how do you know all about it? You will find out later how I know, she replied enigmatically. We were interrupted by the sudden appearance of a group of people so bizarre that again, I wondered if this was all a dream. About a dozen men, accompanied by what seemed to be a woman, emerged from behind a pile of rocks 100 meters from where we were. The sight was even stranger, since these human beings appeared to have stepped out of the pages of prehistoric records. With the gait of gorillas, they brandished enormous clubs which modern man would not have been able to lift from the ground. These hideous creatures were coming straight for us, howling like wild beasts. I made a move to retreat, but my companion told me there was nothing to fear and that I should stay still. She put her hand on the buckle of her belt and turned so that she faced them. I heard a series of small clicks and five of the strongest looking men fell to the ground, motionless. The rest of the group stopped cleanly and began moaning. They prostrated themselves before us. I looked again at Thao. She stood like a statue, her face set. Her eyes were fixed on those people as though she was trying to hypnotize them. I later learned that she was giving orders by telepathy to the female of the group. Suddenly, this woman got up and began, it seemed to me, to issue orders in a guttural voice to the others. They then helped remove the bodies, carrying them on their backs to the pile of rocks mentioned earlier. What are they doing? I asked. They will cover their dead with stones. Did you kill them? I had to. What do you mean? Were we really in danger? Of course we were. These are people who have been here for 10 or 15,000 years, who knows? We don't have time to establish that, and besides, it is of no importance. Nevertheless, it illustrates well what I was explaining to you a few moments ago. These people passed into this universe at a certain time, and they have lived in that time ever since. It's frightful. I agree. However, it is part of natural, and therefore universal, law. Furthermore, they are dangerous because they behave more like wild beasts than human beings. Dialogue would not have been possible between them and us, just as it is not possible between them and most of the others living in this parallel universe. For one thing, they are unable to communicate, and for another, they, less than anyone, understand what has happened to them. We were in real danger and, if I do say so, I have done them a favor just now, of liberating them. Liberating? Don't look so shocked, Michelle. You know quite well what I mean by that. They are liberated from their physical bodies and are now able to continue their cycle, like every living being, according to the normal process. So if I understand correctly, this parallel universe is a curse, a kind of hell or purgatory? I didn't realize you were religious. I just make this comparison to show you that I am trying to understand, I replied, wondering how she could know whether or not I was religious. I know, Michelle, I was only teasing. You were right in explaining it as a kind of purgatory, but, of course, this is quite accidental. In fact, this is one of several accidents of nature. An albino is an accident, and a four-leafed clover can also be considered as an accident. Your appendix is just as much an accident. Your doctors still wonder what use it could possibly have in your body. The answer, no use whatsoever. Now usually, in nature, everything has a precise reason for existing, that's why I list the appendix among the natural accidents. People living in this universe suffer neither physically nor morally. For example, if I hit you, you would feel no pain, but if the blows were strong enough, although without pain, you could still die from them. This might be difficult to comprehend, but it is so. Those existing here know nothing of what I have just explained to you, and it is fortunate because they would be tempted to commit suicide, which, even here, is not a solution. What do they eat? They don't eat, nor do they drink, because they don't feel the need to. Here, remember, time has stopped, those dead won't even rot. But that's terrible. In all, the greatest service that one can render these people would be to kill them. You raise an important point there. Effectively, it would be one of two solutions. What is the other? To send them back where they came from. But that would pose great problems. Because we are able to make use of the warp, we could return many of them to your universe, and thus liberate, one, them. But I'm sure you are aware of the enormous problems that would create for the majority of these people. Here, as I have already said, you have people who have been here for thousands of years. What would happen if they found themselves back in the universe they left so long ago? They might go insane. In all, there is nothing to do. She smiled gently at my affirmation. You are certainly the man of action we require, Michelle, but beware of jumping to conclusions. You have much more to see. She put her hand on my shoulder, having to incline forward slightly to do so. Although I didn't know it at the time, thou measured 290 centimeters, exceptionally tall for a human being. I see with my own eyes that we made the right choice in selecting you. You have an astute mind, but I cannot explain everything to you now, for two reasons. Namely, first, it is still too soon for such an explanation. By this, I mean that you must be instructed further on certain points before proceeding beyond. I understand, and second? The second reason is that they are waiting for us. We must leave. With a light touch, she turned me around. I followed her gaze and stared wide-eyed with surprise. About 100 meters from us was an enormous sphere, from which emanated a bluish aura. I later learned that it measured 70 meters in diameter. The light was not steady, but shimmered, resembling a heat haze when one looks from a distance at sand heated by the summer sun. This enormous sphere shimmered about 10 meters from the ground. With no windows, no openings, no ladder, it appeared as smooth as the shell of an egg. Theo signaled for me to follow her and we set out towards the machine. I remember that moment very well. During the short time we took in approaching the sphere, I was so excited that I lost control of my thoughts. A constant stream of images flashed through my mind, resembling a film in the fast-forward mode. I saw myself relating this adventure to my family, and I saw again newspaper articles I had read on the subject of UFOs. I remember a feeling of sadness sweep over me when I thought of my family whom I loved so much. I saw myself caught, as though in a trap, and it occurred to me that I might never see them again. "You have absolutely nothing to fear, Michelle," said Theo. "Trust me. You will be reunited with your family very soon, and in good health." I believe my mouth fell open in surprise, triggering in Theo a melodious laugh, such as is rarely heard among us Earthlings. That was the second time she had read my thoughts. The first time I thought might have been a coincidence, but this time there could be no doubt. When we arrived in close proximity to the sphere, Theo placed me in a position opposite her and about a meter's distance away. "Do not touch me under any pretext, Michelle, whatever happens. Under any pretext, do you understand?" I was quite taken aback by this formal order, but I nodded. She placed her hand on a type of medallion I had noticed earlier attached at the height of her left breast, and with the other hand, she held what resembled a large biro which she unclasped from her belt. She pointed the biro above our heads and in the direction of the sphere. I thought I saw a green beam of light flash from it, but I couldn't be sure. She then pointed the biro at me, her other hand still on the medallion, and quite simply, we rose, simultaneously, towards the wall of the machine. Just when I was sure we were going to collide with it, a portion of the hull retracted like an enormous piston in the core of a cylinder, revealing an opening, oval in shape, of about 3 meters in height. We regain our feet, Theo and I, on a type of landing inside the craft. She let go of her medallion and with a dexterity that suggested she had done it often, she refastened her biro. "Come. We can touch each other now," she said. Taking me by the shoulder, she guided me towards a small blue light, so intense that I had almost to half close my eyes. I had never seen a color like it on Earth. When we were almost below the light, the wall on which it was located let us pass. That is the only way to describe it. From the way in which my mentor was leading me, I could have sworn I was going to have a handsome lump on my forehead. But we passed through the walls, like ghosts. Theo laughed heartily at the shocked expression on my face. That did me good. I remember that laugh, like a refreshing breeze and reassuring at a time when I was not feeling at ease. I had often spoken with friends of flying saucers and was persuaded that they did, in fact, exist, but when you're actually faced with the reality, so many questions cloud your brain that you think it will burst. Of course, deep down I was delighted. From Theo's manner towards me, I sensed that I had nothing to fear. However, she was not alone. I wondered what the others were going to be like. In spite of my fascination with this adventure, I still doubted if I would see my family again. Already, they seemed so far away, when only several minutes earlier I was in my own garden. We were now gliding at ground level along a tunnel-shaped corridor that led to a small room, the walls of which were of a yellow so intense that I had to close my eyes. The walls formed a vault, exactly as if we were inside an upturned bowl. Thou covered my head with a helmet made from a transparent material, and I found, by opening one eye, that this enabled me to tolerate the light. "How do you feel?" she asked. "Better, thank you, but that light, how can you stand it?"
"It is not a light. It is just the present color of the walls in this room."
"Why present? Have you brought me here to repaint them?" I joked.
"There is no paint. There are only vibrations, Michelle. You still believe that you are in your earthly universe, when you are not. You are now in one of our super long-range spacecraft, capable of traveling at several times the speed of light. We will be leaving soon. If you will lie down on this bunk." There, in the center of the room were two boxes, rather like coffins without lids. I stretched out in one of them and Thou in the other. I heard her speak in a language unfamiliar to me, but very harmonious. I wanted to lift myself up a little but couldn't, being held by an unknown and invisible force. The yellow color progressively disappeared from the walls, to be replaced by a blue that was certainly no less intense. The paintwork had been redone. One third of the room suddenly became dark and I noticed minute lights sparkling like stars. Thou's voice was clear in the darkness. "These are stars, Michelle. We have left Earth's parallel universe and will be leaving your planet further and further behind, to take you to visit ours. We know you are going to be greatly interested in the journey, but also in our departure that will be quite slow, for your benefit. We can watch on the screen you see in front of you. Where is Earth? We still can't see it, being almost directly above it, at approximately 10,000 meters altitude." Suddenly, a voice could be heard, speaking what seemed to be the same language Thou had used moments earlier. Thou answered briefly and then the voice spoke to me in French, excellent French, although the tone was more melodic than is typical, welcoming me aboard. It was very much the welcome aboard of our airline companies, and I recall being quite amused by that, in spite of the unique situation in which I found myself. At the same instant, I felt a very light movement of the air and it became cool, as though air-conditioned. Things began to happen quickly. On the screen, appeared what could only have been the sun. At first, it seemed to touch the edge of the Earth or, more precisely, South America, as I later learned. Again, I wondered if I could be dreaming. Second by second America was shrinking. Australia couldn't be seen, as the sun's rays had not yet reached it. Now the contours of the planet could be distinguished, and we seemed to move around the globe, to a position above the North Pole. There, we changed direction, drawing away from Earth at an incredible speed. Our poor Earth became a basketball, then a billiard ball until it finally disappeared, or almost, from the screen. Instead, my vision was filled with the somber blue of space. I turned my head in Thou's direction hoping for further explanation. "Did you like that? It was wonderful, but so fast. Is it possible to travel at such a high speed?" "That was nothing, my dear friend. We took off very gently. Only now are we traveling at full speed." "How fast?" I interrupted.
"Several times the speed of light."
"Of light? But how many times?"
"It's incredible."
"What about the light barrier? I can well understand that it appears incredible to you. Not even your experts would believe it. It is, however, the truth. You say several times the speed of light, but how many times?
Michelle, during this journey many things will be intentionally revealed to you, many things. But there will also be details to which you will not have access. The precise speed of our spacecraft is one such detail.
I'm sorry, for I know it will disappoint you not to have your great curiosity for all things satisfied, but there will be so many new and interesting things for you to see and learn, that you must not mind too much when information is withheld from you." Her manner indicated that the matter was closed, and I didn't insist further, sensing that to do so would have been rude. "Look," she said to me. On the screen a colored dot had appeared and was growing rapidly. "What is it?" "Saturn." The reader must forgive me if the descriptions I give are not as detailed as he or she might wish, but it must be understood that I had not yet recovered all my senses. I had seen so much in so short a time, and was somewhat disoriented. As we approached, the famous Saturn grew rapidly larger on the screen. Its colors were wonderful, incomparable to anything I had ever seen on Earth. There were yellows, reds, greens, blues, oranges, within each color, an infinite range of nuances mingled, separated, grew stronger then weaker, creating the famous rings and confined within them. It was an amazing spectacle, which filled more and more of our screen. Realizing I was no longer restrained by the force field, I wanted to remove my mask so as to see the colors better, but Theo signaled that I should do nothing. "Where are the satellites?" I asked. "You can see two, almost side by side towards the right of the screen." "How far away are we?" "We must be approximately 600,000 kilometers or perhaps more. They know exactly on the flight deck, of course, but to give you a more precise estimate, I'd have to know whether our camera is on full zoom or not." Saturn suddenly disappeared from the left side of the screen, which filled again with the color of space. I believe it was at that moment I felt exalted, as I never had before. It hit me that I was in the process of living an extraordinary adventure. And why? I had asked for nothing and had never contemplated the possibility, who would have dared, of experiencing such an adventure. Tao got up. "You can do the same now, Michelle." I obeyed and we found ourselves again, side by side in the center of the cabin. It was only then I noticed Thao no longer wore her helmet. "Can you explain to me," I asked, "why just now, you were still wearing a helmet while I was able to accompany you without one, and yet now I have one while you don't?" "It is very simple. We come from a planet bacteriologically different from Earth, which, for us, is a veritable culture medium. Thus, in order to contact you, I was obliged to take this basic precaution. You, yourself, were a danger to me, but you are no longer." "I don't follow you." "When you entered this cabin, the color was too intense for you and I gave you the helmet you are now wearing, which was specially designed for you. Indeed, we were able to anticipate your reaction. During the very short time the cabin was yellow and then blue, 80% of the dangerous bacteria in you was destroyed. Then perhaps you felt a coolness in the air, similar to when an air conditioner is working. This was another form of disinfection by, let's call it radiation, although that is not the correct word, it cannot be translated into any Earth language. In this way, I have been disinfected 100%, but you still have enough bacteria to harm us considerably. I am going to give you these two pills, and in 3 hours you will be able to consider yourself as pure as one of us." As she spoke, she took a little box from beside her bunk, removed the pills and held them out to me, along with a test tube containing a liquid that I supposed to be water. I swallowed them both, lifting the base of my helmet to do so. Next. Well, everything happened very quickly and it was all very strange. Thao took me in her arms, put me on the bunk and removed my mask. I saw that happen from 2 or 3 meters from my body. I imagine that certain things in this book will seem incomprehensible to the unwarned reader, but I saw my body from a distance and I was able to move about in the room just by thought. Thao spoke. "Michelle, I know that you see me and hear me, but I am not able to see you myself, therefore I cannot look at you when I speak to you. Your astral being has left your body. There is no danger in this, you needn't worry. I know that this is the first time this has happened to you, and there are people who panic. I have given you a special drug in order to cleanse your body of all bacteria that is dangerous to us.